Kim Jones, welcome to Show Studio.
Thank you very much.
I want to start in the present because we're in a little bit of sweet spot of time here. It's almost been a year. It's been just over a year at Dior now, and we're about a month away from the show in June. So we've got a nice little reflection period to talk about. So what was your initial aim for Dior when you were appointed artistic director?
I just wanted to really look at Christian Dior's work and what it would be relevant as in, you know, 21st century, so to speak. So I looked at a lot of the archive and particularly also at the background of his life, because there's a huge amount of things before he was a couturier that people didn't know about, especially being, you know, he was involved in a gallery that represented and worked with a lot of the most influential artists at the time, which for me is something very interesting as it's a passion of mine as well.
And were there any surprises when going through the archive? Anything, any pleasant surprises having a little village?
I mean, all the time you find something new. I mean, I haven't gone completely through it because I've got a lot of years to look through it, but I just wanted to find things that defined it for the first season. So, for example, I looked at the idea of his love of nature, which is something I'm also really interested in. I wanted a floral because there was a huge amount of florals in his work. I liked the idea of, you know, the three things that my real thing were based on was the tailoring, the couture element, and then the elegance of Christian Dior as a brand. So that's what I really go for,
yeah,
for anything.
Absolutely. And it's interesting you mentioned that kind of tailoring couture, because I think, and when a lot of people think of Kim Jones, they think your personal brand is so synonymous with sportswear and streetswear, and I know those words are really naff and horrible, sorry. And a lot of what you did at Louis Vuitton was kind of really trailblazing the homogenization of sportswear and luxury. And so now at Dior, I'm interested to see where this sportswear streetswear fits.
I mean, you can, with Vuitton, it was really looking at what the customers were wearing, seeing what they were buying. So, you know, they were people that were wealthy and they wanted to be comfortable. So the sportswear element became something quite logical to do. And then working with different people, you know, the more I did things that were personal, the more people related to it and enjoyed wearing it. And, you know, you would just see, you know, I'd go into the stores and talk to people and see who's buying stuff or read feedback on Instagram or various different places. And I just thought, well, I'm going to look at different things that I like and work with those. And that was how sorts of various things happened, like, say, working with Hiroshi on the fragrant collection. Then I guess the most famous thing at Vuitton was the Supreme Vuitton collaboration, which was Michael Burt, the CEO, calling me wanting James Jebbia's number. And I said, I'll give it to you if you give me a collaboration with them. And so it was a trade, but, you know, it worked out very well.
Yeah, it worked out exceptionally well. And so this whole idea of sportswear, streetwear, which I'm going to keep doing this with, I'm really interested because that whole luxury sportswear streetwear have really been redefined again at Dior. The two previous collections have really been honing in on couture, as you mentioned. And so is that this new regeneration of luxury for you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, Dior's about upscaling. It's a different brand. And, you know, Vuitton was very much luxury leather goods house and Dior's a couture house. So I'm looking at the couture aspects. I'm looking at what the DNA of the brand is and also what people were buying at the brand, because, you know, in English, we have that, you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater thing. So I want to make sales work and I want to also make the existing customer happy and introduce new customers. So it's just looking at what's in the archive. And, you know, I think my favorite collection I've ever done is probably the last one I did for Dior, which was on the moving runway, because it really captivated what Dior was, but then also had that newness of it. But it was very elegant, but also very tough. So I think it had the right balance. So it was a really pinnacle point for me to like move forward in how I want to do Dior.
And actually, it's interesting you mentioned that collection, because I think the music at that collection was particularly magnetic, and that Honey Dijon you collaborated with on. I actually read that during Louis Vuitton, the beginnings of your collection would start from music.
Yeah.
Is that still the case with Dior?
It is. I mean, I'm working on the music now this week with Honey for the next show. And it's kind of, I've got like two different paths for it, because it's just really like, will it be, it's quite a romantic show. So do I want it to be extra romantic, or I don't want to give it a bit of a harder edge? And so yeah, that will come towards the time. But I do tend to listen to a playlist while I'm doing a collection, and then narrow it down. At Beaton, quite often I'd start with a destination from the trunk book and the music that I wanted to use for the show, and then work like that.
That's amazing. Any destinations for Dior?
Dior, if we show in destinations, I'll tailor it to a destination, such as in Japan with Soriyama. But Dior is what I look at.
Yeah.
And then I look at, you know, there's amazing dossiers on each area of Dior's life in the archive that are really well represented. And when we went and did the show in Japan, for example, we had all the information about who his customers were then at the time when he went over. He loved Japan, the things he loved about Japan, you know, the cherry blossom, all those different things. And so we looked just in a way of what came from the archive of Dior that now represents the same thing in Japan. And, you know, then looking at Soriyama as this, you know, artist that's, everyone knows what his work was, but they didn't know who necessarily it was. And I think that's quite an interesting thing to then make something that's a meter high into something that's 11 meters high. It's quite a bold statement.
Yeah, definitely a bold statement.
Yeah.
And it was quite impressive as well, because it's the first cruise show for men's. And was how was that conversation had?
Well, Pietro Beccari, who's the CEO at Dior, has big plans and he likes to think big, and I like to think big, so it's a good combination. And, you know, the one thing about Dior that's really great is if you need to do something, they make it happen. They you know, support every single area of it. And that collection's become incredibly popular commercially, as well as, you know, people loving the images from the collection, and then also seeing the amazing statue in Chengdu in, or in Washington or in Hong Kong. It's like, you know, it's something that becomes much bigger as a sort of, almost people feel like they're, you know, part of what's happening. And I think that's something that's very important now.
Yeah.
In terms of people and fashion,
it becomes a bit more of a kind of cultural moment when you have these huge behemoths. And it's actually kind of serendipitous, because obviously you're known the world over as a globetrotter. And you've been to Japan many, many times, so it's wonderfully serendipitous to me that there's this connection between Dior's archive at Japan and how he thoroughly enjoyed it. And I've read so many stories about how you love Japan as well. And am I right in thinking you collect Soriyama?
I have like maybe four or five. So, yeah. You know, it's just, I collect a lot of art, and it's like I collect different types of art. It's one of the, you know, I have to say, when we work with him and he did things for us, didn't realize how fast he could do it. It was unbelievable. He made that Dior logo for us so quickly, and you think that's all done by hand, and just like it looks like it's, you know, people think it's like done on computer or something. It's just painted, and it's like just brilliant. And you just think, you know, that's a master of his craft, and he owns that category, and it's really, really beautiful. And like some of his paintings are just mind blowing, like the content, because it's like that slightly crazy guy that you love, and like he actually makes those things real. So for me, that's quite interesting.
Yeah. And do you find you get that a lot when you're collaborating with these incredible artists, just that kind of peeling back all these amazing different techniques and ways that people are working?
Yeah, I mean, whenever we look at the artists, we consider the fabrication of what we're going to do for the showpieces. It's like when we did the Astrakhan and lace with the Soriyama toile de jour embroidered into it, so it becomes a very complex thing, or then the silverized shirtings with the lame and things like that, so that it becomes almost like his work. It's respecting his work. And Raymond Petrifon's one, for example, with all the beaded shirts and the different treatments. When I showed Raymond the work in New York, he was really touched by, you know, how we'd enhanced the work and how we'd considered the work. And I think that's the thing that's really important. It's like, you know, a lot of people say, you know, it's funny when you talk about collaboration now in fashion, and people go, oh, is it the end of collaboration? Is it, you know, is collaboration too much? But, you know, when you work in a house where the creative, you know, Christian Dior was a gallerist for 20 years and a couturier for 10 years, it obviously art was a very important thing to him. So you have to understand that it's also important in the message of the house. And I think that's something that's, you know, really interesting to work with. And I think that it actually gives people, information, and you're also informing them on different parts of things that they wouldn't necessarily work on.
And I think that, you know, people collaborate every day. I mean, just being in this room, you're collaborating with you, Nick, everyone in here. It's just how things work nowadays. It's more people see it now. They don't necessarily didn't see it before.
Yeah. Well, you certainly were one of the trailblazers for collaboration. The king of collaboration I've seen dotted around online.
I don't Google myself. unless I need a picture for a haircut.
And there's just been some amazing collaborations over the years that you've drawn in, particularly the ones we mentioned before with Fragment and Supreme and Christopher Nemeth.
Yeah.
A lot of them call upon this amazing archive that you have. What's your point of contact for collaboration? Is it artists, people you aspire, people you're inspired by, who you're collecting?
I mean, with Fragment, there, it was part of a 5-step plan, actually, that we were going to do at VTOM with 5 different things in a row. And Fragment started, it was the first thing. And Hiroshi was, I met him when I was in my teens, when I worked for Michael Koppelman, and I actually thought, yeah, he was the person that really got that scene, the Harajuku scene in Japan going. So I thought it was, you know, I've known him for a long time. I love everything he does. And I thought it would be great to see his interpretation of VTOM also, because he was one of the biggest VTOM customers in Japan for quite a while, so he understood the brand really well. And you know, we had a conversation, it was very sort of smooth and easy to work with, and we said, this is possible, this isn't possible. And you know, we did a really great launch in Japan. I think there was a 6-kilometer queue, and just like, you know, seeing that sort of excitement makes you as a designer think, oh, what can I do to challenge that and make something bigger. I mean, I'm always thinking bigger because I think that's the fun of it. I don't know. I've always thought big. Pietro says always think gigantic, but I think, you know, big is, you know, I'd always think big.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about the collection you have, because your archive is incredible. It rivals student archives, CSM archives, from what I'm hearing.
Well, yeah.
You have kind of collections of Lee Bowery, Vivienne Westwood, over 6,000 vinyls, auction catalogues from Andy Warhol.
I mean, I've got like, I don't know, I think A Magazine just touches on what I've got, and then it's like, there's a lot more. I mean, I think I've probably got about 600 outfits from Westwood, Lee Bowery, Rachel Auburn, Christopher Nemeth, Richard Torrey, Melissa Kaplan. Lots of people that people don't know, but it's all, you know, English design from 1970 to about 1985, 1987 maybe. And I just started collecting, originally I started collecting things like seditionaries and things like that, and just really, you know, things that I loved, I thought they were beautiful. And Stephen Relic was one of the people that would always help me find stuff that was, you know, genuine and real and things like that, which is obviously... And then just, it sort of, people would come to me and say, hey, I've got this, would you like to buy it? Or would you like to buy this? And see things in auction, and just started collecting it. And then suddenly it was just like a massive room full of stuff. And I was like, well, what do I do with this now? Because, it needs to be looked after properly. It needs to be cared for. It's like, it's a full-time job as well. So, you know, everything I've got, from books to magazines to records to art to clothing to ephemera from different places, it's, you know, and things I've collected all around the world, it's like, it's a lot of different things.
It's an incredible library, incredible resource.
Yeah, it is. And I think I'll probably make a big book of it one day, and then work out where the best places for some things to go to be looked after properly.
What is it about the archive that you like so much? Is it the preservation element? How did it start? Were you just
It started like things that inspire me and I like to look at, and things that are around. And, you know, I think anyone that's creative understands that you have things around you that you love and look at and make, you know, inspire you and think of, make you think in a creative way. It's just how things are. Sometimes, you know, I'm not afraid to get rid of things. I like to change things up. And I think it's kind of like, that's why I'm probably quite good at
being in fashion because it's so fast paced. I don't look back at stuff. I just do it and then it's gone and I don't care. And it's like, I don't keep that much of my work, to be honest. I have full archive of the Kim Jones collections, but, and I have one or two pieces from Vuitton. I have a few pieces from Dunhill and I've got things from Dior, but if someone wants it and looks better on them, I just give it to them. It's like, you know, it's
very nostalgic.
Pardon?
Not very nostalgic.
No, not really. I mean, you know, life's a lot of different parts. I don't see it as one, necessarily one full long thing. It's like nice to do different stuff and to be in different environments and to have different things around you. It's just, that's how it is.
Mm. Is there anything in the archive that you were really chuffed to have found?
Some of the Lee Barry pieces, which are really beautiful. It's always funny because it's, I think about stuff and then it comes to me. It's like, it's kind of like I wanted an Anarchy shirt, which are really rare. And I was talking to my friend and showed them a picture of one in a book. And then the next day I got a call from someone saying I've got an Anarchy shirt. So, and it's just like things like that happen.
Luck of the gods on in your favour.
Yeah,
there.
I know. I'm quite fortunate. Yeah.
Anything you're desperately searching for, or if you wish it, it'll come now?
Not really at the moment because I'm quite happy with what I've got. You know, I don't, it's more like I'm just working out what to do with everything I've got whilst also being very, very busy. So, you know, it's taking that time to, I want to have some time to just go through everything, get someone to catalogue it, and then work out what the next stage is.
Is it catalogued at the moment?
Yeah, generally.
Yeah.
Because
so it is really a library.
Everything's catalogued, but it was catalogued for insurance purposes.
Oh, I see.
And then, but it's done like a very nice book, which you know, I can find everything in, and so if I'm in one place and I need another thing, I can call up someone who's at my house or in the studio if I know it's there and say it's there, and they can go and get it and then send it to where it needs to go.
That's amazing. You'll be doing guided tours soon.
Yes. I don't know if I like that many people in my house.
fair enough.
I was quite right. I guess I'm quite private.
Yeah. So amongst that collection is kind of 6,000 strong vinyls. I mean, it's probably grown since that last statistic, but music is really key to what you do, and you were a straight edge back in the day, punk.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of working with Honey Dijon. I just want to talk about that kind of music trajectory that started off with this amazing kind of straight edge punk, listening to Gorilla Biscuits and that kind of thing. How did it kind of transpire over the Louis Vuitton days into now Dior?
I mean, I listen to anything. It depends on what mood. I'll wake up with something in my head and then listen to that all day. And it's just like, you know, it's just, it's stages of life, I think. I mean, you know, I think it's quite funny because we're a generation where we've grown up with so many different types of music and, like, you know, thinking about, like, imagine all of us knocking around at old people's home listening to Jeff Mills and techno and stuff like that. You know, it's like,
never say never.
You have to think, you know, it's like, you know, it's like any sort of thing that, you know, I get into certain moods where I will listen to like complete catalogue things I listened to, say, 10 years ago, and just like want to listen to that for a while. And then I'll go into just listening to classical music for, you know, a month. It just depends on what mood I'm in. And I think it's just, I think that's the one thing that's about being a teenager in Britain. You saw and heard a lot of different types of music. It was very open. So you'd go through different phases of looking and listening to different types of music and just, you know, loving all different types of music. It's completely open.
Mm. Is that one of the reasons why you're so keen on collecting 70s, 80s kind of clubwear culture, because it's focusing around?
Yeah, I mean, it's a time when I wasn't there, and I think it's kind of like, you know, those people are incredibly brave. I mean, can you imagine walking down the street dressed like that when it was quite a, you know, dark time in Britain and quite grey, and just like these people were just like not giving a shit and, you know, wearing all of those clothes. And, you know, they must have been quite intimidating to people, but then I was also susceptible to probably people coming up and being quite aggressive with them, but it was a very sort of strong look.
I want to talk, you mentioned AMAG, so you've actually just guest curated a magazine curated by, and it's very much a snapshot into you and your archive and all the things you love.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about the process of curating that, and where did you start? Was it, looks like you started in your archive or with the people you
It
met?
Started, you know, we started with an A to Z and sat down with Dan Thorley, and we just wanted to, you know, it's quite overwhelming when someone goes, oh, do you want to curate a magazine which you're allowed to control all the different things. I just thought, well, I'll do the different chapters of things I love in my life. So it was an A to Z, and A starts in Africa with a conversation with Naomi about all the things she does in Africa and, you know, projects and places in Africa that are important, and just, you know, different countries within Africa. And it was just like, we were in South Africa in December and really just looking at all the things there. And then, you know, ends on the Z for the zero you will get if you don't know my alphabet, which is that Amanda Lear song alphabet, and shot her wearing all of the first season of Dior that I did. I met her maybe in 2003. I liked her music before that. I think it was Les Child that actually introduced me to Amanda Lear, and I got quite into it, just the whole story and the idea of her. And so it was quite fun to end on the Z for that. And then there's different parts of things, like Hajime Suriyama did nudes of Kate and Bella, and then Kors did Kate, and then I did Bloomsbury because Charleston Farmhouse was somewhere that I used to go as a child. And I love the concept of, you know, Duncan Grant, Vanessa Bell, everyone down there, and how it was almost sort of the punks at their time refusing to do, you know, do things that the government asked them to do, and being also extremely creative at the same time. I collect a lot of Omega Workshop furniture, and I have a lot of the paintings in my house as well, and the ceramics too. And I just, you know, I like the idea of the way they lived. I thought it was really interesting. And it's just a cross-section. I mean, V in the magazine, Virgil did the V in its vinyl, and I've got people like Stevie Wonder, Elton John, Dave Balvin, Victoria Beckham, Lily Allen, all the people I know that have given me, you know, their top 10 records, because I thought that'd be quite interesting for people to see, especially people that are into music.
Yeah. It's like an amazing personal snapshot.
Yeah, I mean, when I sort of think about it, I think I'm very privileged to know all these people and to be able to have, you know, a magazine dedicated to all the things I love.
It's interesting that it's got that such a personal element. I mean, there's something brilliant about your designs, in that whenever you come into a house, you are very respectful in the house codes and looking through the archive, but there's always something really personal about you, I think, in the collections.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't ever really think that, because I see myself as an interpreter of the house when I'm there. And I think that is, you know, it's like, I don't, you know, everyone works in a different way. And I think sometimes when I say that's how I think it should be, that's right for me. But everyone's got their own process. So for me, I think that's how I work best. And I do take, you know, so I was talking to Tim Blanks a while ago, and he said that he felt he could see a lot of my early work in Dior, which I don't think about, but maybe it's just inside, you know. But I do take it and you work it to make it into your thing. But, you know, as you're a designer, you evolve, you want to evolve, you want to do new stuff. So my work at Dior isn't the same as my work at Vuitton, and it's not the same as Dunhill or Kim Jones or all the other different things I've done. It's, you know, you take what is Dior and then you work with that. I think it's really important to be respectful, and it's also the thing that makes you excited and challenged about doing things.
Absolutely. And you could argue that bringing in Yoon and Matthew has been a little bit of your personal touch on there.
Yeah. Oh, I think people like community. I think people find things interesting when they have, you know, when people can relate to a house. I think it's really important. And I think having someone from the West Coast, having someone from Japan, having someone from England, you know, you give a bigger scope to things. And I think that's kind of very, you know, important for consumers and people that want to get to know the house to have, because they find an area they can relate to.
Something approachable for a
little
house.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, really important. I want to talk a little bit about that community that you're curating around yourself, because and all the different opinions and vantage points that you're bringing in. So Matthew and Una are actually the first two that are kind of almost in-house collaborators.
Yeah, they are. They're part of the team.
Yeah, very much so. And bringing in all these different artists kind of adds a community element again, would you say?
Yeah, completely. I mean, the artist is really a reflection of Christian Dior's work as a gallerist. And he also worked with artists on his own, you know, on his collection. So that they come in and each season, it's almost like someone that I think would be really suitable for the season. It's like Kors, I thought was great for the first one because, you know, Christian Dior worked with Picasso and Salvador Dali, who were like the huge artists of their day. And Kors is, you know, the artist of his generation, so to speak, because so many people know what his work is. And, you know, you think about how much he just sold a painting for. You know, he's probably going to be the most expensive living artist in his lifetime. So, you know, he's still young, he's still working, and it's like you think of things like that. And the reason that I thought Kors would be interesting is because I went into the archive and there's a... First thing I saw was a perfume bottle of Bobby, who's Christian Dior's dog, and it was quite a sort of Korsy-looking sort of statue. And so I messaged Ryan and I said, do you want to... would you like to work on Dior? For the first season, I'd like to do something relating to Christian Dior and his relationship to his dog. So naturally, the BFF, one of Kors's famous art pieces, became the centerpiece for the show, and then asked him to rework the bee. And that's just how it happened. And I thought it was like, you know, I think the interesting thing about that show is it still resonates to now. It's still something that if you're scrolling through Instagram, a picture of it will come up. You know, it's like it's when things have longevity, you know, when fashion's so fast and people, you know, you'll see like all the shows at Showtime and then they disappear. Mm. And if something lasts longer than that, then I think it's successful.
Yeah, sure. It's like we were saying earlier with that kind of cultural milestone that you're creating. And it's interesting that you mentioned Bobby, because you have this innate sense for detail. And I noted in that collection, there's these tiny little dog chains, bones, and that Yoon and you worked on, and these little tiny wonderful elements that you might blink and you'll miss, but on closer inspection, further the narrative.
I just love I love little accessories, and I love you know, any sort of like earrings and things like that that you can add to an outfit, especially when you're doing tailoring, which a Dior is essentially about. It's things that make it different to other tailored houses. That's what's really important for me. I didn't want it to be stuffy. I didn't want it to look old. I wanted it to be relatable to young people. And it's like, yeah, then I go to the store in New York and I speak to people that work in the one in Soho, and they say that a lot of the kids at NYU save up to buy Dior suits to graduate in with all the accessories, which is kind of an amazing concept and idea that that's, you know, now that's what people graduate in.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I love the idea of these graduates going down into
all. Yeah, they'll have all the little details. You know, one of Matt's clips as a belt. You know, like an earring by Yoon. It's like, you know, all those different things mixed up together. And I think that's kind of really fun.
Mm. And these little accessories are always an entry-level point as well for various different consumers. You're kind of covering everyone.
It's like, I always like... You know, when I go shopping, and I'm quite bad because you go and you see there's a counter where you're paying and it's like you see lots of nice things there. I'm like, oh, not that. And it's like, you know, it's just, you know, a lot of people, I think, shop like that. And it's kind of, you know, you're lucky, you know, all that big birthday present for so-and-so or this or that. So I was thinking that way.
Yeah.
It's called merchandising.
Yeah, I guess we're all inner magpies to some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And talking a little bit about kind of travel as well, because you are an avid globetrotter, as I mentioned before. Your childhood was kind of incredible, growing up in Africa and Ecuador, and you make a habit of traveling a lot. There was a statement I read that said you want to explore all parts of the world.
Yeah, I want to see most of the world. I want to see pretty much all the world before I die. I think that's the fundamental thing about being alive for me personally. Just because I love seeing different cultures, I love seeing different places, I love seeing different wildlife, I love seeing the way different people live. You know, our world's like, everyone says the world's very small, but you still go to places and they're completely different and people are living in different ways. And I think, you know, looking at the history of the world and looking at this, the history of humanity and all those different aspects, for me is just something really interesting. It doesn't really apply to my work at Dior. At Vuitton, it was something that I looked at because the trunks that were made at Vuitton at the beginning were generally for people that were explorers. So there would be a story behind one, so I could use that story for the seasonal inspiration for it. And that's how we started the collection, is like opening the book and seeing which trunk would be good for us to start the point with. But, you know, for me, I just love to see everything. I like to be away from cities when I want time out and just be in places with my friends, having a bit of an explore. I'm not really a lie down on the beach person for a holiday, although I have started to like that, but I normally have to have done quite a lot before I can lie down. It's usually for about 2 days. So
I was going to say, how do you switch off?
Well, being in nature.
Yeah, being in nature.
You know, being in nature, just, you know, seeing different parts of the world. You know, that's for me the thing that I love.
Yeah. I've read someone that you were saying you've got kind of safari eyes and you're always picking up on the tiniest little things. Is that a real part of travelling for you? It's just picking up on the minute details.
Well, when I was a kid, I used to like catching snakes and lizards, which was always quite potentially dangerous. And I would just be looking for anything that moved. And so when you've done that, when you're young, and it's like you go somewhere like Kenya and you just see an odd shape on the horizon or like something move, you can identify what animal it is immediately. I mean, I'm pretty good at recognizing any single animal that you can see. And just like, you know, I'm always looking at that because it's something, you know, it's just part of me. It's like, and sometimes I'll drive a tracker mad because I'll see everything before them. And just like, it's like, but we always have a joke about it. But it's just, you get in, it takes about 2 hours and then I'm really focused in on seeing everything. And it's, I guess that's how I look at fashion too. It's like, I look at details and I look at different finishings. And it's like, I'm quite terrible. And I always say, apologize when I'm dealing with people, because I'll be like looking over their shoulder at what someone's wearing or looking at, you know, like, or painting on the wall and things like that. But it's like, it's just because that's how I've always been. And it's not like, it's just that's it.
Like a sponge.
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of animals are you playing with when you're younger? You've got me worried now.
There wasn't a point where I took a baby king cobra and a coke bottle into a golf club in Botswana. And I was sort of like banned from being and left alone for quite a while.
Oh my gosh.
And not allowed out of the house because, you know, baby snakes are much more poisonous than adults because they don't know how much venom to release. So they can be potentially more dangerous. But, you know, I was just like grabbing hold of anything and running around with it. So it was, you know, it wasn't always something that was really, you know, interesting to me. I've always loved reptiles. I think they're really fascinating creatures. And I think, you know, when you see them in the wild, it's quite a privilege because they normally know you're coming first and disappear.
Do you have a menagerie at home?
I've got a dog.
Just pooted.
Not the dogs, yeah.
Yeah. I'm interested in this nature obsession because it definitely came through in elements of Louboutin, certainly with the Chapman brothers reworking all these fun little animals. But for now, it kind of it's much more the floral, harking at the Dior's archive that informs Dior.
Yeah, there's a touch of animals in the next one, but it's like, you know, Christian Dior was very, you know, he loved nature too, and he would always go to his country houses to sketch and to be on his own, to think between collections. So it's that thing of just, you know, I think the elements fit well. You know, I think it's just, you know, it's just something that is part of me. And I guess that's so it's just, I do it in my work. I don't know how else to describe it. Some things I just do automatically.
Yeah, just innate.
Yeah, exactly.
Absolutely. And interesting, you mentioning kind of dual sketching in nature. What's your sketching habits? Have you got a notebook on you at all times?
Well, now you have an iPhone, you don't need a notebook.
Yeah.
You can just scribble things down and on an iPad and then just do it. You know, it's like, then it's easy to send someone. It's like, there in a second. It's like, you know, we have quite a fast design process. Everything we do is really fast because we've done probably about 6 collections since we started at Dior. So it's kind of like we're already prepped up until winter 2020 winter show, which is in January.
That's so really organized.
It's not designed, but it's prepped. But we've working on fall, which we show in November. We've already finished summer, and we're waiting for that to come back, and pieces are coming in already. So that shows on the 21st of June. So that's quite well organized. Yeah, it's the 28th today. So
that's very organized.
Yeah,
I'm impressed.
It's just how we are.
Yeah, very pragmatic. And it's interesting that you're talking about kind of doodling on an iPad and iPhone, because that seems quite a digital way of working, but actually thinking about your kind of archive and the way you're noticing everything, that's quite analog almost in a way.
Yeah, I think analog's important in luxury because you need to be able to see the finer details of things and to see, you know, that what a fabric is was something very important to Vuitton. I mean, both at Vuitton and Dior, because the prices are high, that when you're doing stuff, you need to see it in real, that's for sure. So when we were doing research, we would go and look at things in real to make sure that we were giving the best possible product after, you know, to go to store. So we'd look for things that other people wouldn't see, and, you know, and we still do that.
Yeah, it's important, essential. It goes back to that attitude of just making sure you're spotting everything, the devil in the details, which is something that...
Yeah. We like to have a lot of little pieces here and there and everywhere.
Absolutely. And I want to talk a little bit about your mentorship, because you had amazing mentors throughout your career, Louise Wilson and Lee McQueen. And am I right in thinking the AMAG you've curated is in kind of an homage to Louise?
Yeah, it was for Louise. I mean, I just put dedication of Louise, Lee and Judy in there, because they were three people that I would have asked immediately to have put, you know, to you know, work on something for the magazine. I just thought it was like really, you know, for me, they were, Lee and Louise are the two really important people. Louise gave me the confidence to go and do what I needed to do, and Lee was always there to say, you know, fuck them, go and do it, and don't listen to people, listen to yourself and things like that. I do listen to lots of people, but I listen about practical things. I don't just, if someone says something, it's like I always assess why it's been said rather than if it's relevant. You know, it's like if it's relevant and it's said in a way that's useful, then I listen to it. If it's something where you can tell they're jealous or they're just being difficult, I'm just like, that's in one ear out the other. I don't take, you know, I don't listen to much, you know, in this day and age when you've got lots of people trolling and things like that, which can be quite hurtful sometimes. I just like, it's like, you know, it's their fault, not your fault. And it's like, go and do something with your life rather than just sit and hate everyone. That's my biggest bit of advice to any troll. But it's like, I think you've just got to listen to the people that you trust, that, you know, have the taste and know what they're doing. And that's the advice I'd give to anyone that's, you know, coming out of college or going in college. And, you know, why you've gone to college, is it because you like the tutors? Because you think it's a good college? Do you, you know, and then, you know, it's like how to focus on stuff like that. And, you know, I went to St. Martin's because I wanted to do menswear, and I got on with Louise very well. I also worked a lot to pay to go to college, and did a huge amount of my work in the evening. So I didn't really have a huge interaction with my year. But that's how I had to do it. It was just like, you know, I didn't have another choice. I was working 4 days a week and in there one day a week. So it's... I think everyone's got different things, but I did, you know, Louise gave me a lot of confidence to do what I do. And with Lee, it was really the backing up of that. And also, you know, I mean, he was such a genius, and the fact that he liked what I did was a really massive compliment. And the fact that he was like a bit of an older brother to me was a really amazing thing. And, you know, I still wonder what it would be like if, you know, he was around doing fashion now, how that would have evolved, because you think about the last collections that he was doing that were becoming very futuristic and super, like, almost like sci-fi. And it was kind of how it would be now.
That, it's interesting that you mentioned sci-fi in the future, because that's feels like something that you were quite in touch with yourself.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, that's a few people have said that. But I think you can take very, I think my clothes are very of now. And I think the way they're styled is a little bit more futuristic. And I think then the way we set it and put music to it, it becomes more futuristic. And I think there's a real balance when you work in a big label that's a commercial label, that you have to be aware of. The clothes have to be resonant for now and for people to be able to wear them and to understand them. And almost when you're doing luxury, there's a certain timelessness that must be there because the clothes cost so much money. And I think that's why when we're styling, we think about very much the future. Yeah, I don't know. It's just, it's how I see Dior. He was really futuristic for his time and ahead of his time. So that's why he became such a massive success. And I think that's it. I mean, you can go futuristic and avant-garde, and you know that won't work for a large, you know, company. And then you can do, you've made style clothes that are very classic into something very in a modern way, and that becomes understandable to people. And so it's just work. It is very logical the way I work. It sounds boring almost.
No, it's very just, pragmatic.
Yeah, I don't know if it's an English sort of background or idea, but it's just that's how I think and work, and that's how most of the people that have worked with me for a long time and been with me for a long time are too.
It's a clever way of doing kind of these little digestible bits of modernism and future, so that people don't even realise it's happening, and then before they know it, they've got this really modern suit on.
Yeah, I mean, it's a modern but classic suit. It's not going to be like weird, sort of too many weird details on, because then it gets gimmicky. I think it's just, you know, like the oblique, which is the one button double breasted suit that we've done, actually comes from something from like, I think, 1957. And actually 1955, and we just liked it. But the original thing from the Dior archive, which was a women's piece, where we just took all the buttons off apart from one and started looking at it as a concept like that.
I know you mentioned that you're kind of looking at Dior as a gallerist in the archive, but what's the difference in the archives? Because obviously Louis Vuitton is very much trunk and travel. Do you find you're like calling upon women's archive quite a lot?
The only part of the archive I look at is at the moment is Christian Dior's work personally, so it's all women's wear.
Yeah.
But, you know, women's wear from the late 40s, early 50s is, you know, relevant to menswear now. Plus also it was a real tailoring base. There was a huge tailoring base part. You know, the sashes we did for the last collection really came from that famous, that was actually something that came from the first Saint Laurent collection, which was photographed by Helmut Newton, that famous picture of the woman between, no, Richard Avedon, sorry, with the woman with the elephant. And that sash is a really beautiful eggshell blue. And I thought that would be great to interject into a suit in a way, without it looking, you know, like a gimmick. So that was actually a scarf that became a sash, and then we played with it like that. And so it was taking something that looked very heroic in an image and making it heroic on the runway.
And actually something I've noticed is that with that sash and the scarf and looking at the clothes up close, there's, again, talking about those minute details, but everything seems adaptable.
Yeah, it has to be, you know, I like everything to turn out into one real piece. And so you can unbutton the sash and it can become something. But, you know, we get a huge amount of people asking for that for red carpet or for, you know, people getting married. It's like, it's a real, you know, it's become this thing, and it's something that I want to continue because it becomes a Dior signature, and it's very elegant and chic, and it's got everything that I want Dior to be, which is, you know, the couture, the tailoring, the elegance. It's all in one thing. So it's really good.
Yeah, it's kind of synonymous in that one item. I want to rewind a little bit, talking about kind of studying and Louise. Were you working at Gimme 5 when you were studying?
Yeah, I was.
Yeah. And so tell me a little bit about that, because I know that kind of sparked this domino effect of Japanese streetwear influence and Good Enough.
I met Hiroshi, I met Nigo, and I met Jun Takahashi there, because Michael would always introduce everyone to everyone when they came in. He was extremely generous. And also, he would also give you the clothes, which no one else really had at the time. So, you know, I saw Undercover and it was just like, I was blown away by it, because it was like, you know, I guess it was, you know, people describe it as streetwear, but it really wasn't, because it was like full on fashion and the production values on it and all of the clothes and the detail with the things that I became very obsessed by. And I was just like, you know, these people, I mean, it was always really expensive then. And I was just like, these people are making stuff that's really, really good. It's like, you know, well, with Nigo, for example, I felt it was quite like Andy Warhol making clothes. Because the branding was so spot on and every single detail had branding on. And then with Hiroshi, he was reinventing, you know, American sportswear in an interesting way, using Good Enough and things like that. And then with Jun, it was just like, started with punk, but then moved in something completely different. And also a little bit alien and a little bit sci-fi, but just it's like everything about the clothes was amazing. And just, you know, I was working in a bit of the production, a bit of the quality control on Hysteric Glamour when I was there. And so I learned about how to, man, you know, not only, it wasn't about the making, but it's about, you know, how to run a label. So that helped me a lot when I graduated, because I knew where to go to a factory or how to, you know, cut multiple things at once and things like that, which I guess a lot of creative students that go to fashion colleges wouldn't think about. So it gave me a lot of advantages because it was very hands-on, and you know, I learned as much there as I did at St. Martin's, I guess.
I also think there's something really interesting about Japanese streetwear, that it's so steeped in tradition, unlike sometimes American streetwear sportswear. It's so steeped in tradition, and often how it's made is kind of a real labor of love, particularly with jeans and denim, and it's almost got that high fashion element to it.
Yeah, well, I think the Japanese have the best vintage in the world. You know, they really, a lot of American great vintage went to Japan, like I think in the late, you know, I don't know, 70s, 80s, I'm not sure it was, but, you know, you still find the best Levi's there, you find the best Snoopy sweatshirts there, you find, you know, things in mint condition that you would never find anywhere else. And you know, it was a real sort of, you know, there was a hunger for those clothes and an excitement about those clothes, and then making brands around those clothes that became mutated by the, you know, Japanese reinterpretation of it. So it was really interesting.
It's really interesting that it's kind of come full circle with this Japanese branding kind of setting off a spark, and now this first cruise show in Japan. And so
I know it was very, you know, for me to do my first really big show abroad, it was quite an emotional experience, I have to say. It was kind of a wow, you know, I'm doing this really amazing show with a good budget and like an amazing concept in Japan, and it was like really exciting.
Yeah,
it's quite challenging doing a show in a different country, but it's really interesting. And it's like, you know, I'm always open to a challenge.
Yeah. What kind of challenges were you experiencing?
It's just, you know, it's just not, you know, when you're doing a show, I guess when you work for a house, you have your fitting rooms and you have the places you show set up, you're used to it. And there was like different things, like, you know, there was a lot of moving around and doing stuff, and it was just different, but it was really great. I mean, I loved it. It was just, you know, things like, it was just, you adapt to stuff very quickly.
Yeah,
you have to.
It was a blockbuster.
Yeah.
Just to kind of wrap up, I want to talk about kind of what's next. What you mentioned that you've got quite a few seasons planned out already, but kind of what's the dream scope? What's the pinnacle?
I take it as it comes. I don't plan. I just do. That's what I say. But I have a plan for collections, because I will always want to know how one collection will look next to each in the store. And we have three collections at once in the store. So for me, it's important to be organized with the collections in advance. And then, you know, just go from there. That's how it is. I'm not planning anything. I just do it.
No,
someone asked me to do something, I'm interested in it, I'll do it. If I'm not, I won't.
Thank you.
Cool.
Thank you so much.
No, thank you.